This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, President Obama calls for de-escalation of tensions between Russia and Turkey. Spending booms to fight crime and terrorism.
Gun manufacturers, armored tanks, digital surveillance companies are all seeing this as an opportunity.
Russian athletes and systematic doping under scrutiny. We'll also look at a list of the best music of the year. These stories and more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. NATO foreign ministers are looking at ways to beef up security along Turkey's border a week after Ankara shot down a Russian fighter jet along the Syrian border. Officials at a foreign ministers' meeting in Brussels said Tuesday those additional measures could include more ships in the Mediterranean, more alliance planes at Incirlik Air Base in Turkey, and a bolstered missile defense system. The ministers described the situation along Turkey's borders with Syria and Iraq as highly unstable. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said members should decide in the next few weeks on specific measures it would take for Turkey. President Barack Obama, meanwhile, is hoping to ease tensions between Turkey and Russia. He spoke on the sidelines of the climate conference in Paris, where VOA White House correspondent Aru Pandey talked with International Edition host Sarah Williams.
The president was pretty clear. He said that we have a common enemy, and that is the Islamic State militant group. And he said that he wants to make sure that all countries focus on that threat and focus on the need to bring about a political transition in Syria. So he basically, you know, said that Turkey and Russia should tamp down these tensions and, again, refocus their efforts on who they're fighting in Syria, and that should be the Islamic State.
How did Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan respond to Mr. Obama's comments?
Well, it's funny. He talked a lot about diplomatic language and the need for diplomatic language. He said diplomacy should be sufficient in order to resolve what he called problems in the region, and he talked about the de-escalation of tensions between his country and Russia. He said, quote, we don't want to invest in tensions. We want to avoid tensions. And he said that if tensions do arise in the region, all of the parties involved get damaged in the end, and that we want peace to prevail at all costs. So hearing from Erdogan in Paris and then also out of Ankara, where the Turkish prime minister also called for a de-escalation with Russia, and also saying that Russia should keep the diplomatic channels open for dialogue. So on the Turkish side, it seems that there has been kind of an outreach effort to let's rely on diplomacy and tamp down tensions. For its part, the United States and President Obama today reiterated what he has said before, that Turkey is a NATO ally and that the U.S. supports Turkey's right to defend itself, its airspace, and its territory, and that the U.S. is very much committed to Turkey's security and its sovereignty. Of course, Russia says that it did not violate airspace when its fighter jet was shot down about a week ago. And Putin, of course, has rejected calls for a meeting with Erdogan on the sidelines of this climate conference. And he instead is accusing Erdogan of basically shooting down the fighter jet in order to protect its oil supply from the Islamic State militant group, which Erdogan has vehemently denied and said if those charges prove to be true, he'll resign. So clearly the need for this meeting to tamp down the kind of escalation of words and tensions between Turkey and Russia, and President Obama again asking both countries to refocus their efforts on Syria, on the fight against the Islamic State militant group and the political transition in Syria.
White House correspondent Aru Pandey in Paris. U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter says the United States is deploying a specialized expeditionary targeting force to Iraq to put more pressure on Islamic State militants and be in position to conduct raids over the border in Syria. Testifying before the House Armed Services Committee Tuesday in Washington, Secretary Carter said the deployment was being done in cooperation with the Iraqi government. President Obama says climate change is an economic and security imperative that must be tackled now. Speaking Tuesday in Paris, he called climate change a massive generational problem, but one that could be solved. Ken Baldwin is a professor and director of the Energy Change Institute at the Australian National University. He explained to International Edition's Victor Beatty the primary objectives of the 12 days of negotiations.
I think the goals of the Paris meeting are to, for the very first time, obtain an international agreement on the path forward to keeping global warming to below 2 degrees. Whether this creates binding targets is another question, but the important issue is that all countries agree that this is a goal that we have to achieve.
This is going to be costly?
It will certainly cost money, but that will pale into insignificance compared to the cost of doing nothing about climate change. If we allow business as usual to continue, the reports such as the Stern Review all show that the economic cost of the damage due to a high degree of global warming is significantly greater than the cost involved in mitigating the effects of greater CO2 emissions.
How do you expect these nations that are gathering to achieve their objectives?
The way in which this could be achieved is through nations to agree to, first of all, commit to their INDCs, their determined contributions, that will at least set national goals for reducing emissions on a time frame for the next decade or two. But more importantly, there should be a commitment to continually revise these targets in order to ensure that the world is on trajectory to achieve a reduction in emissions by, let's say, 2050, that will mean that we will keep global warming to below 2 degrees centigrade.
Is the technology keeping up with these hopes?
Certainly. This is a completely feasible prospect that we could reach the point by 2050, at which time global emissions have been reduced to such a level that a 2 degree future is, or less, is certainly guaranteed. The question is whether the nations of the world have the willpower or indeed the commitment to undertake the reductions that are needed.
Of course, there was a gathering somewhat like this some 6 years ago in Copenhagen, which fell short of expectations. Is there a possibility this will do the same?
There is a possibility that will happen. However, I would suggest that a number of things have changed during that time. Firstly, there has been an increasing awareness of the long-term disastrous economic effects of dangerous climate change. There have been greater realizations of the problems associated with pollution in general. And the other issue that has changed the landscape is that major countries, particularly the US and China, have taken leadership on the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions in the lead up to the Paris conference, which has set the scene for other countries to rally behind them and to make a much more unified approach this time round compared to Copenhagen, where there was very little leadership in the lead up to the Copenhagen conference.
The Reuters news agency is reporting that the world's 48 poorest countries will need to find some $1 trillion U.S. dollars between 2020 and 2030 to achieve their plans to tackle climate change. Will the goals set out by this meeting put an undue burden on these poorest nations?
Certainly there has to be some burden sharing across the international community. That is a subject for discussion and negotiation at the Paris conference. And the aim would be to ensure that the major emitters and indeed the historically largest contributors to the current carbon dioxide burden in the atmosphere, i.e. the developed countries, that they take on a higher proportion of the burden in order to assist the emitters who will contribute the rest of the CO2 burden in the atmosphere in coming years to change and adapt their economies in a way that keeps global warming to below 2 degrees C.
Professor Ken Baldwin is director of the Energy Change Institute at the Australian National University in Canberra. He spoke with International Edition's Victor Beatty. French President François Hollande announced France will be giving African countries $2.1 billion over the next 4 years to develop renewable energy sources and replace fossil fuels. The recent terror attack on Paris and the threat of more incidents is prompting authorities and governments to bolster their reliance on technologies to fight back. Eric Markowitz is a senior writer for International Business Times who's written extensively about advanced technology. He joined International Edition's Jim Stevenson to discuss how authorities are investigating in a variety of tools to maintain safety.
After any sort of big terrorist attack, and we saw this with 9/11, probably most prominently with the creation of Homeland Security, is governments tend to spend a lot more money on anti-terrorism technologies, companies, and what companies are kind of seeing right now is an increase in those budgets will likely trickle down into the private market, and gun manufacturers, armored tanks, digital surveillance companies are all seeing this as an opportunity. You can look at it cynically and say they're profiting off of this and they're cashing in, or you can look at it and say, well, maybe if governments had used some of these devices or had some of these tools or equipment or weapons, they'd be better equipped to deal with terrorist threats.
We're talking about all sorts of different things, from police body armor to video equipment and even drones.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, in fact, I was recently at one of these big exhibitions. It very coincidentally was in Paris just 3 or 4 days after the terrorist attacks. And drones were really the big product that everyone seemed to have an eye on, both for tactical missions, like a small drone that could enter a restaurant or a theater and do some surveillance so that you don't have to send in officers, but also more general surveillance drones, ones that would hover above a city that police could potentially use just to keep an eye on citizens.
Some of these technologies are really interesting, like robotics.
That's right. A lot of the robotics have been around for a while now. You know, these robotics are used to, let's say there's a suspicious package, to go and pick it up and assess through a video camera, or even some of these robotics are now equipped with actual bomb detection technologies. So there's definitely an interest from governments looking at these sorts of technologies. Companies are certainly waiting eagerly to see when budgets kind of increase and opportunities that they may have.
Individual budgets for cities, nations obviously will vary, but as a whole, this industry must be huge.
Yeah, it's tough to quantify, really, especially on the international market, but it is, of course, a trillion-dollar marketplace. Just looking at percentages, one percentage for me that stuck out was the expenditures for drones, actually. It was interesting. There's one statistic that shows that it's going to grow about 34% just this year in Europe. So there's definitely an interest. And, of course, you know, these are not typical devices, and they are somewhat controversial for privacy rights. Certainly in Northern America, there are plenty of activists and people who feel that the police should not have drones just sort of carte blanche monitoring people above their backyards and in the street, wherever they may happen to be. So while the market looks good, there are certainly some concerns from privacy activists as well as just common citizens.
While you were at the Paris Security Expo, I'm sure there were plenty of things that you were familiar with, at least conceptually. What were some of the things that perhaps they were looking into the future toward?
One of the things that is sort of here a little bit, but it's definitely a bit more futuristic, are some of these Stingray surveillance devices. Basically, they're called IMSI catchers, and they can intercept cell phone messages and telephone calls. These devices have been around for a while, but their use seems to be gaining traction, and certainly there were plenty of manufacturers there that were very interested in speaking with governments, lauding the technology's capabilities of intercepting messages. And I think that this is definitely something that we're going to be seeing a lot more of in the next few years.
Eric Markowitz, senior writer for International Business Times, speaking with International Edition's Jim Stevenson. This is VOA. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. Russia is feeling the pressure as its athletes and sports officials come under investigation for alleged involvement in doping. Russia's sports minister met with the head of the World Anti-Doping Agency last week and promised anti-doping reforms after more Russian athletes were suspended as drug cheats. This week's hashtag VOA TV program looks at the problem of doping in sport, and host Michael Lippin tells us more. Michael?
I was joined by three panelists for a great discussion about how recent doping scandals are affecting sport worldwide. The panelists included international sports lawyer David Larkin, who's based here in D.C., and two other experts whom I spoke to via Skype. One is Scott Douglas of Runner's World magazine in Portland, Maine, and also British sociology professor Ellis Cashmore, who is in Birmingham in England. One question I asked them is whether Russia will clean up its act quickly enough to persuade the International Association of Athletics Federations to let Russia's athletics team participate in the Rio Olympics next year. Here's what Scott Douglas had to say about that.
If I had to bet today, I would say that there won't be a Russian track and field team at the Olympics. The evidence in the report was so damning that to then say that within 4 months they were able to clean up all of that, that would look really, really bad for a sport that has said that we are going to do whatever it takes to get to a point of clean sport.
Well, I've got a question now for Ellis Cashmore. Let's turn it around to the World Anti-Doping Agency and the IAAF. How serious do you think they are about getting Russia to clean up its act?
Well, I think that they've got to, for the sake of show, signal that they are entirely serious about this. But I'm not sure I go along with Scott and I predict that they would exclude Russia from the Rio Olympics. I think that would be a draconian step and probably a step too far. Consider this. If they kick out Russia, saying, clean up your act, we've given you enough warnings, and we have a damning report, and you haven't got time to turn it around, so you are out of the Olympics and probably the next World Championships the following year. Russia may say, hang on, okay, if we're taking the hit for this, what about Kenya? What about the United States? What about Jamaica? And really, we have a domino effect. Now, what happens in that situation is that the sponsors of track and field begin to get worried about this and say, hang on, what good is an Olympics for us for marketing purposes if we don't have the powers where our markets lie being displayed on the screen every day right. for 3 weeks? So I think then the masters, and let's not kid ourselves, the real masters of track and field at the moment are the sponsors, the likes of Canon and Seiko and Toyota. And these are where the millions are coming from. And I think that they're calling the shots. So I think they will say, go a little bit easy on Russia, give them a slap on the wrist and allow them to come back. And maybe over the next couple of years, people will forget about all this.
Well, Dave Larkin here in the studio, Ellis did bring up Kenya.
Right.
And Kenya seems to be the one African nation most under fire for doping. Why do you think Kenya is having such problems at the moment?
Well, I think, you know, you look at the track record in the last 3 years. I think we're now up to, 40 athletes that have allegations of doping leveled against them and or bans. And so it's really been a hot spot. And with the latest allegations against the senior leadership, I mean, we had the athletes storm the federation this past week. Something's seriously wrong in Kenya. It's been known for a while, and it's finally come to the forefront.
Well, for more on that discussion, you can check out our show on its Facebook page. Search for #VOA, and you can watch the show right there.
Thank you, Michael. And time now to check out what's trending online. Social media correspondent G. Abby Lee is here with us. Hello, G.
Hi, Ray.
So what's on the menu today?
It's about a hashtag that's been trending for the past few years on the first Tuesday of December. So Thanksgiving Day falls on the last Thursday of November. The day after that is Black Friday, when many retailers roll out the biggest sale of the year. And the following Monday is Cyber Monday, when the deals move to the web. In recent years, Small Business Saturday and Giving Tuesday became a thing as well. So, Ray, are you confused yet?
Yes, I am. I know the days of the week, but now I'm lost.
So let me recap. It's eat, shop, shop small, shop online, and then give. So 4 days of utter indulgence before giving something.
So when did hashtag Giving Tuesday start, and what is it exactly about?
It only began in 2012. It's a 24-hour online campaign dedicated to encouraging people to support philanthropic efforts. So that includes making donations to charities and volunteering at different organizations. It also has a website, and the address is givingtuesday.org. The campaign gained momentum on social media platforms, mainly through Twitter. Its Twitter handle is @givingtues and has about 41,000 followers.
Well, that's quite impressive. Mm-hmm. Is it a mostly American movement or worldwide?
Ray, that depends on who you ask. The organization's founder, Henry Tim, says it has grown into a worldwide movement, but I'll say it's a still rather American concept. It raised $45 million last year, which is huge, but the movement involved mostly American nonprofit organizations, and more than 15,000 organizations participated last year. And this year, more than 30,000 organizations joined the movement, so that's double the figure from a year ago.
Well, those are some significant numbers. Mm-hmm. How real is the impact actually outside of the social media platform world?
Great question. So Blackbaud, a software and services provider for nonprofit organizations, has a report on that. The report says online donations jumped a whopping 470% since hashtag Giving Tuesday began in 2012. And speaking of Giving Tuesday, Facebook founder and CEO Mark Zuckerberg is giving big. He announced he's giving away 99% of his Facebook shares to charity during his lifetime. His share of the social media company is valued at $45 billion today, and the news came in a letter to his newborn daughter, Max. Ray?
Not a shabby way to announce his firstborn. Thanks, Jeep. She tweets for our VOA International Edition Twitter account at VOA underscore IE and from her own account at Gabby Lee. That's JEEABBEYLEE. This is VOA.
News is mobile and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views. Presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us, free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition from Washington. The music streaming service Spotify announced its end-of-the-year list for top artists of 2015. International Edition's David Byrd tells us who made the list and who leads the all-time standings.
You used to call me on my cell phone, late night when you need my love. Call me on my cell phone, late night when you need my love.
Spotify users were grooving to Drake's Hotline Bling and other tunes from the rapper in 2015. He had 1.8 billion plays from 46 million listeners, making him the most streamed artist globally on Spotify. Last year's winner, Ed Sheeran, finished second. The Weeknd, Maroon 5, and Kanye West rounded out the top five. Rihanna topped the list for the year's most streamed female performer with 1 billion plays. She topped a pretty impressive list that included Ariana Grande, Nicki Minaj, Beyoncé, and Ellie Goulding.
Here we go, not long ago, when you would walk on the sidewalk, innocent, remember, all we did was care for each other.
Lean On, a collaboration between Mo, DJ Snake, and Major Lazer, earned the most streamed song honors for 2015 with 540 million plays. Lean On finished ahead of Omi's Cheerleader, Uptown Funk from Mark Ronson and Bruno Mars, See You Again from Wiz Khalifa and Charlie Puth, and Ellie Goulding's Love Me Like You Do. The Weeknd's album Beauty Behind the Madness was the most streamed album of the year, beating out Drake's If You're Reading This, It's Too Late, and Major Lazer's Peace Is the Mission. Here in the United States, Drake was the most streamed artist, and his album If You're Reading This, It's Too Late was also the top of the list. Nicki Minaj topped the list for most streamed female artist in the USA, followed by Beyoncé, Rihanna, Ariana Grande, and Lana Del Rey. Fetty Wap's Trap Queen was the most streamed track in America.
What do you mean? Oh, when you nod your head yes, but you want to say no, what do you mean?
Justin Bieber earned the distinction of the most plays in a single day with 36 million streams on November 13th when his album Purpose was released. Ed Sheeran is the top streamed artist of all time with more than 3 billion streams and 59 million listeners. Overall, Spotify said that 75 million listeners streamed 20 billion hours of music in 2015. The company also has more than 20 million customers paying $9.99 a month for ad-free listening. That makes Spotify the most popular paid streaming service in the world. And that's without Taylor Swift's 1989 and Adele's Hello. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
What do you mean?
That's it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news and information along with features, videos, and podcasts on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Pakistani farmers are gaining access to global markets with some assistance from the United States. The U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, held a ceremony recently showcasing a successful agricultural program that shared modern techniques with 27,000 farmers and helped to increase agricultural exports by $34 million. USAID's agribusiness project worked with both small farmers and larger producers to increase productivity and quality while reaching new domestic and international markets. The four-year program, which just ended, created jobs for 14,000 Pakistanis. The farmers of Pakistan have tremendous potential, and USAID is committed to supporting farmers in adopting modern best practices and technologies, said USAID Mission Director John Groark. Some of the program's achievements include a 300% increase in income for 800 women who process apricots in Gilgit-Baltistan, an improvement in the quality of chilies from Pakistan, and improvements in cuts of meat for the international export market. USAID is continuing to support market-led growth in the horticulture and livestock value chains through a recently launched U.S.-Pakistan Partnership for Agricultural Market Development. U.S. assistance has reached more than 800,000 rural households and financed irrigation initiatives for more than 480,000 acres of farmland in Pakistan. The United States helps Pakistani agribusinesses access financing, form partnerships, and tap into more lucrative markets with the goal of linking thousands of local producers nationwide to major commercial firms by the end of 2016. More than 26,000 new jobs can be attributed to USAID programming in the last 4 years. Through USAID efforts, the incremental sales for Pakistani businesses in the past 5 years have increased by more than $144 million. And the revenue generated by the exports for the targeted commodities, a large part of which is agricultural produce, has increased by $57 million. The United States is proud to work with its partners in Pakistan to help Pakistan's agriculture fully realize its tremendous potential.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.